session number 16267, reel 1.
Mr. Smith, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Western Supermare, here in this town, in the little road.
And that was in 1932?
That was 1932, yeah.
What did your father do for a living?
I think he worked at the coal company, the coal and light company, you know, like the old gas company as it was then.
Did you go to school in Weston?
Yes, I lived here till I joined up in 1949.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
14.
So that was in 46?
That's right.
Do you have any Second World War memories?
Oh, lots. Well, yes, I certainly do.
What type of things?
Well, I don't know why they picked on our street, but I mean, I had an incendiary bomb come through the roof in Stamford Road, and my mother just dragged me out of bed to take us down to the under the stairs. It was there. We never had the Morrison shelter, and we got under the stairs, and the incendiary bomb came through and landed on the bed. And Mr. Holder, opposite, who was a special police constable, he came racing across up the stairs because he'd seen it go through the roof, so he said after. And he put it out, and we were very lucky then.
What was the address?
That was in Sanford Road, 35 Sanford Road, in Weston.
How much damage was done to the house?
Nothing, just a hole in the roof. He'd seen it go through the roof, and burnt the mattress and the bed, but we were lucky he'd seen it go through.
What approximately would have been the date of that attack?
I think that was in January 41, I think. Yeah, I think it was. 5th and 6th, I think the raids were. Yeah.
How much bombing did Weston get?
Quite a lot, for such a small town. They were after this factory out here that made bow fighters and whatever, you see. They had what we call a shadow factory out here. It's now Westlands, helicopters. But there was another one further over, which was Aerojets. And during the war, they made bow fighters and other. And after the war, of course, they made prefabs. You know, they turned over the prefabs.
Do you remember which parts of the town got hit?
Yeah. The Bourneville Estate, where we're sitting now, got quite a hammering. Quite a lot of people died on it. Because it's near the factory. The factory's just over the back of those houses there. We believe that's what they were after. I mean, nobody's ever come to tell us anything else.
What were the defences of the town like?
As I remember, just a barrage balloon up on top of the woods, over the top there. That was all there was. And as kids, we said, oh, and they had a barrage balloon over it. No, they had a searchlight at the top of the woods, near the reservoir. And down in Langford Road was a RAF man barrage balloon, and I can't remember any more. But what you got to remember is only about 8 or 9 at the time.
Any anti-aircraft sites?
No, not that I knew of. There could have been, but I don't think so. Never ever heard any, you know. And as kids in them days, everything that happened you wanted to know about, you was racing around trying to find.
Was it a miserable or an exciting time for you in the war?
For me, it was an exciting time. But for my parents, I should imagine, with 6 kids, you know, and I should imagine, and it was a terrible time for them. But for me, a boy, I was over the fields trying to dig up unexploded incendiary bombs. Oh, we bring them home. We were bringing them home in 2 or 3 at a time, and me mother was going mad. And she'd call the police, and they'd come and take them away.
Yeah. Were there ever any accidents to lads?
No. Mostly, see, it was just the fins sticking out of the ground, you know, but to you, it was a bomb, and that was it, you know. In fact, I see one the other day in a museum in Torquay. I said, look at that old incendiary bomb. I remember picking them up as a kid, you know. Yeah.
Was it to swap with other lads?
Yeah, it was a swap for bits of shrapnel that we used to find on the seafront. Just go along in the mud, feeling in the mud, and as soon as you trod on something, you pick it out, it might be a lovely piece of shrapnel, shiny. It might even still have, like, German writing on it. You can always tell German writing with the squareness of it all, you know. And it was exciting. You wash it off and run up the beach. Everybody gathered around. Yeah, you know, it seemed terrible at the time of people dying that, but it was for a kid of what, 9 and that, it was an exciting time. It really was.
Were you ever frightened?
No, I can't ever remember being frightened because I never found anything to be frightened of.
But frightened of the bombing?
No. We don't realise the danger, do you? Mother and father knew the dangers, but we didn't. And of course, when the Americans come, it was even better still.
Why?
Oh, wow. My first taste of peanut butter. And they used to go around this, in Lock-in Road. There was a Chamberlain Hall, they used to call it. And there's the square is still there. And if I ever walk by there, I look at that square of concrete, and that was the galley. And the times I've stood outside there with these big American friendly men giving us peanut butter and ham and things we'd never tasted before. My mother used to take their washing in. Mum used to do it, and they used to give her cigarettes and tins of fruit. Oh, it was a great time.
Were they friendly towards the children?
Oh, yeah, they were wonderful men. And then one day we just woke up, and they were gone. There was just a few left. They'd gone overnight. And kids, you sleep tight, don't you? And I expect everybody, all the grown-ups in town heard it, but as kids, we woke up and we just couldn't realise where they'd all gone. And they'd all moved to the south coast, ready for the invasion.
What about the celebrations on VE Day and VJ Day? Do you remember anything of that?
I remember that very well. We were, 12? Yeah, I suppose I'd be about 12, but I wasn't old enough to do anything. I wasn't old enough to get in the pictures. I wasn't old enough to go in the winter gardens dancing. I wasn't old enough to go in the pubs. But as a kid, we'd go up on the seafront, and we would just run up and down, watching everybody else enjoying themselves. And then, of course, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of RAF personnel in town because of the camp out here, Lock-in Camp.
Which was celebrated most, VE Day or VJ Day?
VE. Had to be, you know, because it was so sort of near and personal to nearly all of us. My dad was dying then. He died. He was in the BEF in 1940. He went over with the BEF. He contacted tuberculosis in France. He came back and he stayed in bed from 1940 to 47 when he died. He got up and then again, but he died of tuberculosis. I remember my mother at the government at the time said he wasn't he had it before he joined up. And she said, she told me since. She said, but if he did, why didn't you pick it up when he had his medical? So she went all the way to South Wales to see. I can't remember if it was Morrison. He was the health minister in the war. He was a Welshman. He was a Labour man, but he was a Welshman. But she went all the way to Wales. She sat all day outside his office to see him in the end. And I was only like what she told her. But she came back home and he got his pension. His war pension, yeah. He's got a war grave up in the cemetery now. And only just recently did his name go on the memorial in the Grove Park.
So you got TB in the army, in the BEF?
That's right. That's right. He came home on, I got it all upstairs, all his tags that he had on the ship, you know, Dorsetshire. Was it Dorsetshire? I think it was a Dorsetshire. He came home on from France. He missed Dunkirk. And pulmonary tuberculosis, it was on the ticket. I got the tickets and all that upstairs, what was attached to his, you know, when he was on the ship. Like.
Was he in the infantry?
Ordnance Corps, attached to, I think, the 51st Highland Division. Right? But, of course, in the First World War, he was in the Battle of Jutland on the Vorspeit. He was only 16. He was in the Royal Marines, see? That's what made me join. He used to come home and tell, you know, he used to tell me when I was up, and when he was ill in bed, I used to lay up there, and he'd tell me stories. He'd say that Admiral Beattie said to him, "Now, listen, Harold, look after the ship while I'm going down and have a cup of tea." Of course, being a little kid, you believe it, you know. And I used to tell other kids in the street that my dad had to look after the ship. Well, you know, he was a good old dad, he was, yeah.
When did you join the Marines?
1949. I was exactly 17 and 3 months to the very day.
And what job had you been in before that?
I was only a laundry, what they used to call me, wishy-washy. I was the, I used to deliver laundry, you know, on the back of a van, you know, just delivering the laundry to the houses and that, you know, with this old driver, Mr. Poole. Good old boy as well. And, I couldn't see nothing in that. And a couple of lads come home in their uniforms, you know, in the different, one was in the black watch, come on with his kilt on and all that, and I thought, oh, I'm going to join the army. But then I thought, no, I'd join the Marines. So I did.
Was it easy to get into the Marines?
Yeah. Very easy. I mean, a medical was strict enough, but I got in easy enough.
What was your training like in those days?
Pretty hard. I mean, if you're happy, the training, I should think, is pretty easy. But I was homesick. It was terrible. I'd never left my mother's side, you know, until I was 18. I'd never been out of Weston, not within 20 miles, anyway. And when I first got down to Deal in Kent, it was terrible. I couldn't believe it. I remember saying to the lads the first morning we woke up, I said, who's making our beds? That's how, you know, I was really. I said, I wonder who makes our beds. I mean, we soon found out who made our beds, you know. But within a few weeks, I was into the routine, but I was terribly homesick for about 6 weeks. Terrible. I felt like running away, you know. Then I stuck it out. Once I got over the training in Deal, which was the marching part of it, the ceremonial stuff, you know, and passing out in the discipline. And once I got past there, I was all right. I was as happy as a fanboy then.
Where did you go to after Deal?
Went to Portsmouth to do what you call your gunnery training. I was in the gunnery school there. And then you went on HMS Royalist, which was out in the harbour, a ship out in the harbour, do your naval training, like, you know, your seaman training, make you corporal of the gangway for a day, and, you know, you have to do all the duties, so then keyboard sentry and all this sort of thing. And then from then you pass out there, and then we went down to Limpston, which is now the Commando Training School, but as it was then, it was called ITCRM. It was the Infantry Training Centre, Royal Marine. And because the Commando School then was at Bickley in just outside Plymouth. And I remember at the ITCRM one day, I was going through a little bit of a bad patch. And this officer called. I was called into the CM, the CO's office, and he was saying to me, you know, what's up with you? You sort of, you know, you're not with us. And if you don't sort of line yourself up, I'm going to have to, you know, discipline you. And I said to him, I said, well, what's happened is, the day I moved from Portsmouth to here, my family moved from here, Weston, to London. Place called West Ealing, and we went like that, and I didn't know where they were, and they didn't know where I was. And he said, is that all it is? I said, well, I haven't, you know, I haven't been able to, I've wrote letters and nothing like that. Anyway, about 2 hours later, he called me back in the office, gave me mother's address, and he gave me a weekend pass. He said, go on. And I was all right after that, then, you know. And
what kind of training did you do at Limpston?
Infantry training, you know, fire, crawl, observe, and all that. You know, the stuff they, like the army do. You know, there was obstacle courses, if you put them better.
Was that just as hard as Deal?
Always harder than Deal, because Deal was only marching around, wasn't it? Doing your swimming and your marching up and down and getting yourself, you know, disciplined. You know what I mean? And, I mean, things they used to do, you know. But, that was harder, physically harder. But by then, see, you were disciplined, and once you're disciplined in a corps like the Marines, it becomes easy because you just do things automatically, not in a stupid way, but you do. If an order is given, you do it, and that's it. And it becomes easy, and you get used to it. And in a way, it's quite satisfying, you know, to be able to say you do it. If why today I can't understand, you know, the lack of discipline. I think is sometimes, you know, a terrible thing, you know, with kids.
How keen were you to get into action?
I hadn't even thought of it. I was never one of the gung-ho type. You know, I'd never one of those. I'd never thought of getting in this, getting in there, and, you know, I'd never, ever. All I wanted was to do me training and then be posted, say, to Malta or Cyprus, if it was about then, I can't remember, or Malaya was where we were originally going. I mean, once I passed out at Bickley at the commander school, I was on my way on the Devonshire to Malaya, 45 Commando, I believe. But we were all diverted at Colombo, I think it was.
Did you go to Korea?
Yeah, we were told then that we were going on down to Singapore, and the names were read out. Though this list here will go to Korea, and then the rest will go on to Malaya, where they were going originally. And I was one of those picked to go to Korea.
This was in 1950?
1950, August. I remember my embarkation leave. And then when we got to Singapore, we were taken to Changi. Now, I'd never heard of Changi, but it was the old Japanese prisoner of war camp. And a lot of terrible things went on there, but being, what was I, 18 then, to 18 and a half. Never knew a lot about it. People told you when you were there. In fact, we used to even go down on Changi Beach while we were waiting for these planes to come and take us up the ground. We were swimming off Changi Beach. And it wasn't until about the middle 60s I was reading articles in papers about Changi Beach, where a lot of terrible things went on, where the Japanese just hoarded Chinese and prisoners out into the water and just set up machine guns on the beach and wouldn't let them back in. You drowned or you died. They'd done all this, and they reckon the beaches were red with blood, people trying to crawl out. But we were swimming there, and we didn't know all this had gone on. But by now, it's back to being an RAF base when we were there. And they put us in a Royal New Zealand Air Force Dakota. There was an Australian one took some up, and we went in the other one. No seats, just the little scoops on the side, like a paratrooper, where you all sat in a long row by the... Wasn't that's all they were, and we flew from Changi, which is Singapore, and we flew right up to Kure in Japan. Tokyo, actually. Stopped off at Borneo once to fuel an RAF outpost there. Then we went on to Philippines, and that was my first taste of American hospitality and food, because up to then we dropped down into the Philippines, Clark Air Base in the Philippines, and big buses came out, like these American school buses, you know, the one, I mean, they're all the same shape, whichever film you ever see or whatever country you're in, if it's an American school bus, they're all the same shape. Anyway, they took us away and they put us in these. We'd never had luxury like it. This is how the Americans lived. It was an Air Force Clark Air Base. And then the first thing they'd done was took us down to this massive place to have, like, canteen, we call it, but they call it a mess hall. I mean, steaks. I've never seen steaks like that. I mean, and we get sweet potatoes and sweet corn. Never had any of this. I'm not saying we're like animals, but we were like kids pressing their nose against the window and watching the other people eating. It was beautiful. I had steaks, and these Americans, they couldn't. We had no money. They lived. They had script, what they call script, American forces money, and they were giving us handful of it. And it was really, really, you know, and all their wives, and they were inviting us back to their homes, and they were saying, you know, like things like, you know, God damn, you're going up there to help our boys in Korea and all this, and oh, God, Lord. We stayed there 2 days, I honestly sometimes think it was the best 2 days of my life, because they were really nice people. I've always admired them. I mean, you know, you get the odd loud mouth, but as hospitality goes, I think the Americans are some of the finest in the world. I just have to say it, you know, it's true. I mean, I know people that don't like them and always running them down. You can always find something bad about some people, but the majority, even now when I go to these Royal Marine dues and, you know, 41 Commando dues in there, and the Americans are there, they're so giving. They don't seem to want anything back. They just want to give.
And then after Clark Field, you went to Japan.
Well, we flew over. I remember we pulled down into Okinawa. And, of course, the war had only been over out there then, 4 years? No chance of clearing anything up. And when we flew over circling the land, over the island, the landing craft under the water. Some still up on the beach, you know, but the majority from up above and the clearness of the water, the Pacific green, you could see these landing craft and small ships and boats all under the water from the air. It's just a mass of boats all around and under the water, you know, where they'd been sunk off the shore. We landed there, we stayed there 12 hours, and then we flew on up to Kure, which was the British sector of Japan. Another night there, I think. It took us nearly a week to get up to Tokyo. Terrible plane, that Dakota. Oh, it was awful. And then we went out to Tokyo.
What happened to you in Japan?
In what way? Where we went? Well, we went from there. We were taken in lorries. God, that took ages and ages. We went to a place called Yokosuka, where we went to a camp called Camp McGill, naval camp on the coast. And I remember on the way, we dropped the canvas off the side of the truck, you know, because it was a real hot day. It was really hot then, it was in August. And their weather's similar to ours anyway. And I remember seeing Mount Fujiyama for the first time. What a beautiful sight that is. Well, whenever I see it now, I think, you know, what a lovely mountain that is. It's sort of almost perfect shape, you know, up, across, and down. And then we went down to Yokosuka, Camp McGill, where we'd done some training. And we hadn't been there a week, and we lost a man through a... I don't know the exact details, but I do know that they were using... they were using mines, but they were using dummy mines and prodded for them, you know, just to practice and, you know, train it. And somebody, I can't say it was American because I don't know, but somebody gave them a live one. And it went up and killed this young kiddie. I got photographs upstairs in the funeral. And, yeah, I've been there now. And, think that was, well, I can't say his name because I just don't know. I mean, I think even one that came out on the plane, because some come out on the plane from England, didn't they, in civvies and had to fly as civilians. They got there a little before us. And then after that, we just training with these 10-man canoes, you know, where you put the leg over the side and cut out like these American 10-man rubber dinghies.
Put your leg over the side.
You have one leg in the water.
Why?
Well, because that's how you sat on them. They were canoes with thick rubber all the way around the sides, and you sat along the gunwale. Like, you sat there with your oar, and there was 5 men either side, or 4 men either side. Might have been one up forward and one at the rear. 10-man rubber dinghy. I've got some photographs of them upstairs when. Alvary Gascoigne come and visited us at Yokosuka, the British ambassador to Japan. And we all lined up with all our equipment in front of these big barracks. Another experience, you know, American hospitality. It was a naval place this time. Club there called the Saddle Club. equivalent to our Nafi. It was like the Hilton as opposed to, you know, a little backstreet hotel, you know. Well, it really was something. And then we done a lot of training from then.
So you were obviously preparing for
raids. We were preparing, that's right. And then one day we just upped and went to Yokosuka. Although I say we were at Yokosuka, we were outside Yokosuka, 20 miles outside. We went to Yokosuka, which was a big naval base. It was one of the biggest Japanese naval bases in, you know, in the war. And we went off there and we boarded two boats. One was called the Wontuck and one was called the Horace A. Bass. And they were troop carrying destroyers. Some other of our lads had gone off about the same time off the American submarine, the USS Perch, which was a troop carrying submarine, you know, but I'm glad I never went on there because they said after it was awful. When they had to just lay in their bunk all day and just breathe as little as possible. But we went off on these destroyers. And we took with us war correspondent from the Reynolds News at the time. He was a Labour MP. I can't think of his name at the moment. Tom Dreiberg. He was the war correspondent, and I've still got cuttings upstairs that he wrote in the Japan News, which is an English-speaking newspaper in Tokyo, and newspapers here, of course, Reynolds News, and a lot of other papers printed his story. And we had him on board, and I was with Condren then. Remember Condren very well, Scotchman. Never ever gave any impression that he was, you know, a communist. I don't think he was. I just think he was brainwashed when he was there, and that was it. He was taken prisoner and brainwashed, and, you know, some people are susceptible. You can't say, you know, well, he shouldn't have done it because you don't know how you would have reacted, you know. I could have been just the same because I've always been a socialist, so I could have just turned the same way as him. You know, if they could have just put pressure on me, I don't know. I hope to think I wouldn't, but he went off, and I remember that reading on the paper, he went to university, took university degrees in well, as you know.
Teaching, yeah. Mm.
And he was given a pardon later on in life and come home. But we went off on this raid. I don't know where it was. It was right up North Korea somewhere. Went ashore, and I was part of the baggage party, we used to call ourselves, because we had to carry the explosive. It was American made, and it was in bags, like, you know, like you had a respirator bags, you know, and it was all in bags like that. So you'd put about three or four on either shoulder, and you had to take it all up the beach and drop it at a point and then go back and get more, and then the engineers would take it off of there and put it where they wanted, on the railway line and in the tunnel. And then you'd form a, then you'd help and go back and form the perimeter, you know. But we never really had any trouble up there.
So this was to block the East Coast Railway?
That's right. Because there was a railway running, that you couldn't run a railway down the middle. It was all mountain, wasn't it? And we done a real good job. It was, I can remember paddling away from there in these canoes. And when it went off, I felt the heat on the back of my neck. I really did. And what, we were quite a way out into the sea. I mean, we were heading back towards the destroyers. And that was about 300 or 400 yards inland. But the heat of the explosion, as Dreiberg said at the time, it was the biggest explosion of that war. It really was something. And I felt the back of my neck, and, you know, really hot. We never had a helmet